All right.
Tarek, addict, alcoholic.
Tarek.
Page 75 in our big book. You know, before we start there, I had a gentleman walk up to me during the break and ask me about knowing when you've had a spiritual experience and believing that you haven't had one. And the question was, do I need to go back and start over? And my question was, well, what's your definition of a spiritual experience? And it's interesting because, you know, he made a comment about the white light experience or getting the big boom. And the reality of it is that maybe some of us don't need the big boom or the light white light, because the white lights and the big booms have about killed us our entire lives. And what if the spiritual experience is nothing more than a change in perspective? A change in perspective. Looking at the world and the people in it from an entirely different angle. To actually say to yourself, this person is a manifestation of God. So therefore, do I treat these people that I interact with on a daily basis as if they're extensions of God? There's a spiritual experience. For me, one of the spiritual experiences I had was when I started to go through life situations that I handled in an entirely new way. That, to me, was a spiritual experience. I just handled that unlike any way I've never dealt with a situation like this. Usually what happens is I shut down and I go in hiding. Well, no, I stood my ground and I was able to do it with some dignity and some respect. Holy shit, that's brand new. How'd that happen? A new level of awareness. A new sense of power and peace flowed in. These are spiritual experiences. Feeling victorious over crack cocaine was a spiritual experience. Feeling like I stood on the top of a mountain and the wind blew through. That's what it felt like when I went a long period of time without having a mental obsession for crack cocaine. That was a spiritual experience. Some of the amends that I made were spiritual experiences. You know, placing an outcome entirely in God's hands and being okay with whatever happens, I'm sorry, but that's a spiritual experience for me. I don't apologize, but that's my description. What do you want to add in on this?
So when we get to the sixth step, I'll explain a spiritual experience that happened to me that was so profound that I didn't even know it happened. So I don't really have a whole lot to add right now, but I'll touch on it here in a little bit.
Okay. Another one, just real quick, that came to mind was during my first fifth step, when the hatred for my father disappeared. That was a spiritual experience. I hated the man. I wished he was dead for the first 31 years of my life. And then all of a sudden, because of the inventory in the fifth step, I saw myself. I knew I had become my father. And from there, I became compassionate. So these are all spiritual experiences. So I hope that helps the individual that asked the question. When we decide who is to hear our story, we waste no time. We've written inventory and we're prepared for a long talk. We explain to our partner what we're about to do and why we have to do it. He should realize that we're engaged upon a life and death errand. Do you believe sharing your inventory with another man or men is a life and death errand? Most people approaching this way will be glad to help, and they will be honored by our confidence. This next paragraph here is the fifth step promises. Who here has done a fifth step? Okay. This is a checklist. We pocket our pride. We go to it. Did you illuminate every? And the word every means all. Twists of character. Every dark cranny of the past. So when I listen to a fifth step, I ask a series of questions, especially with new guys. And here they go. Have you ever been involved in a homosexual experience? Have you been involved with murder? Have you been involved with rape? Have you been involved in abortion? Have you been involved in molestation, armed robbery, murder, covering a murder up, and bestiality? Over the years, I've had that every single one of those questions answered. Every single one of them. And that gets all the dark crannies out. That also breaks the ice. So when I listen to a fifth step, we're going to give you both sides of the fifth step. Giving a fifth step, we're listening to one, and telling one. So right now, it's a combination of both. But some of those questions I just asked may not show up in your resentment, fear, or conduct inventory. So how else do we get at them? Nowhere in the book are those questions listed, except right here, every dark cranny of the past. And that's what those questions do, is they pull out every dark cranny of the past. That pretty much covers it all. You will get high or drunk over the one thing that you don't talk about. I don't know what the spiritual law is that equates to that, but I've watched it over and over. So my experience abundantly confirms that's what usually happens. That's why the solitary self-appraisal is insufficient. Once having taken this step, withholding nothing back, there you go again, withholding nothing, we are delighted. So here's a question. Were you, those of you that raised your hand, were you delighted when your fifth step was over? Were you able to look the world in the eye? Were you able to sit alone in perfect peace and ease? Did your fears fall from you? Did you begin to feel the nearness of your Creator? Did you begin to have a spiritual experience? Something was different. You maybe felt different. You were looking at the world different. People looked different. I don't know what your experience is, but I'm just asking these questions to maybe start prodding at what may have happened. The feeling that the drug or the drink problem has disappeared often comes strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. What does that mean to you? Broad highway, spirit of the universe. Don't let prejudice deter you from asking yourself what these spiritual terms mean to you. So you complete the fifth step. Those of you that completed the fifth step, how many of you did the hour returning home? Okay. This is what the book says. Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour. Carefully reviewing what we have done, we thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. I believe that the reason I thank God because I know Him better, because I've seen what I'm not, and as a result of seeing what I'm not, I have grown closer to what my true essence possibly could be. Therefore, I'm growing closer to God because the great reality is deep down within. That's the way I look at it. I know more truth, and God is truth. So if I learn more truth about myself and discover more truth about myself, I discover more about God. Carefully reading, taking the book down from the shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first five proposals, we ask if we've omitted anything. For we are building an arch. Here we go again, construction verbiage. We're building an arch to which we shall walk a free man. Is our work solid so far? Question number one. Are the stones properly in place? Well, what stones? The keystone? The cornerstone? They talk about some foundation stones. Are those properly in place? So they're asking you to go back and review the foundation of the first step. Review the second step, the cornerstone. Review the keystone, which is the decision you made in the third step. And they ask, if you skimped on the cement, do you have too much fellowship and not enough solution? There's a question to be answered there. Have you tried to make mortar without sand? And you sit and you contemplate and you examine these proposals. And you can you sit for an hour in perfect peace and ease? And so I'm a very by the book kind of guy. My, you know, the guys I sponsor, they have to complete this hour returning home. It's part, the fifth step is not complete until this hour is done. So these,
but why is that?
Why does the hour returning home must be done?
Yeah. You want me to answer? I'll just answer it. For me, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Brandon. For me, the importance of the returning home is because I can think that I got everything. I can think that I got every dark cranny of the past. And if I sit there and do this when I return home, if I miss something that I need to work on, God will show it to me. And that's why I think this is vital, is because there are some things that you're going to be shown, maybe, that you need to then call the guy that listened to your fifth step and say, hey, I left this out. And I've had it done where guys have gone home, and they said when they returned home, there were these three things that they just, they kept to themselves that they weren't going to tell me, and they intended to tell me, but it came out, so they called, and then we talked through them. And so, because you don't get free until you know you're free. And that this is where you get that last little bit of freedom. So, that's what I think.
All right, so we're both going to swap our, we're going to share experience with, because there's not much in the big book about step six and seven. It actually says this: if we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step six. If we can answer those questions about did we skimp on the cement, have we tried to make mortar without sand, and so forth, there are great review questions. You know, Brandon asked that question, and I sat with it because he stumped me for a second. And I think it's just, for me, it's an extension of the fifth step. It's to review our work to make sure it's solid so we can move forward into the next step. We've emphasized the willingness as being indispensable. Are you now ready to let God remove from us, from you, all the things which you have found objectionable about yourself? Can God now take them away, every one? If we still cling to them, we will not let go of them. We ask God to help us be willing. I so don't like the way this is written anymore, because it's implying that God can do when I'm ready, right? It's totally up to me when this stuff happens. It's is the way it's written in the book, and it doesn't sit well with me anymore. And so when I am ready, I say something like this: my Creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in my way of being useful to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. So notice, the third step until now was one long prayer. There have been many spots in the book where they said, in meditation we ask. Now they've said the amen. So everything between step three and step seven has been prayful action. We walk through the action, and we ask for God to guide us and direct us through that action. And so one of my worst character defects, I believe, is the capacity to fall asleep, to become unaware, to become driven. And I don't think I have much of a choice in that. It's just part of my experience. But I want to share something with you. Can we hit the projector? And so while this starts up, Brandon, why don't you jump in here on six and seven? I'll come back.
Okay. So I believe that if I've done a thorough fourth step, and my sponsor has gone through it with me and identified the defects that I'm experiencing, then this question of are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable. There's an implication in that question of, I've actually admitted that the defects that I saw and my fourth and fifth step are objectionable. I have to actually have done the work to the level to where I no longer want this crap. This stuff has showed up. It's dominated my life. It's dominated my relationships. It's blocked me from having a real relationship with anybody around me. At this point, I shouldn't want it. It should be crystal clear that this stuff is trash. But I have to get to that point. And if I've done the fourth and the fifth step correctly, by the time I get to six, I don't want it. Take it. Because if I get to six and I still think that some of those character defects that I have are working for me, then I'm not going to ever get free. So that's why I like the extended third and fourth column, the theater of the lie, like we showed, like we talked about. The checklist may be fine, but I don't see how the checklist gets you very easily to fully admitting that these things are objectionable to you. So the first, my six-step experience, the first time I went through the steps, was the most powerful experience that I had around this step. But it was funny because I didn't know I had it. This is the spiritual experience that I didn't know I had. So I was told by my sponsor to go home and sit with the sixth step and meditate on the defects each day until something happened. And I said, well, what's going to happen? He goes, I don't know. Something's going to happen. So go sit on it until something happens. I'm like, okay, I'll do that. So each morning I would sit in meditation. I'd go through my defects and I would sit there in meditation and I would just say, all right, God, what's going to happen, right? And nothing would happen. And so there was this one morning where I'm sitting there and I had come to the conclusion that I wanted to meditate on the mother of my children and that relationship. So I'm sitting there in meditation. I'm all perfect and here she is in the forefront of my mind. I'm thinking about her. And there's this other thought that keeps crashing in. It's trying to push the thought of her out of the way. And I'm, you know, with all my mind power that I have, I'm trying to keep that outside of my mind. But it keeps coming in. So I finally stop and say, okay, I'll meditate on this. And it's a incident that happened to me when I was a child that appeared to have really no significance whatsoever. And it comes into the middle of my consciousness. And the best way I can describe it is that all of the defects that I've been meditating on form this little, there are all these little dots out here. And then in one moment, that experience from childhood like gets connected and it creates a picture. I don't have any idea what the picture is, but it's like a constellation. And I see how all these defects are tied to this one experience as a child. And I'm sitting there going through this experience and I am absolutely just weeping, like just bawling my eyes out because I'm starting to see how this incident that I thought was so insignificant was the driver of so much of my life. It was driving the way that I approached relationships and why my life was dominated by sex and how I could never get enough and how all these things were going on around me. And I'm just absolutely overcome with this feeling of just, wow, how is that one thing creating all this? And so it's Wednesday night. I go to a meeting. My sponsor comes and joins me and I ask him how his day is. We're after the meeting. We're hanging out in front of his car. And I ask him how his day is. And he tells me. And I say, okay, listen to this cool thing that happened to me in meditation this morning. And so I describe it probably in a lot more words than that. And so he asked me, he goes, so when you have your six-step experience that's going to make you be free to go say the seventh-step prayer, what is that going to look like? And I said to him, I don't know. I have no idea what that's going to look like, but I can't wait for it. It's going to be awesome. And he goes, tell me that story that you just told me again. So I told him the whole story, the extended version again. And he just looks at me and he goes, huh, do you think that might have been that six-step experience that you were waiting for? And like all of a sudden it was like, oh, it did happen. Something did happen. That I can pick one point in my life and identify the majority of my character defects and have this incredible weeping experience. And I'm so blind that I don't even realize that I'm in the middle of one of the coolest spiritual experiences of my entire life. Because I am so... I'm waiting on this one thing that I don't know what it's going to look like to happen, that I don't see it when it happens. Because I'm so blinded by my own mind. And so from that moment I go and then I say the prayer. I go around the corner to a church and I light some candles and I say this prayer. And I leave there with this sense of contentment. This sense of just knowing that everything will always be okay, even though my perception might be a little bit skewed. And then when you have experiences like that, and you have, thank God I had a competent sponsor that could show that to me. I also carry around a lot of the comments I get from people that listen to my fifth steps. Here's some of the this one's not dated, but I defects and ideas, beliefs that no longer work for me. I have a demanding nature. I need to control. The idea that others' behavior defines me. My validation comes from others' behavior. The idea of I always do my best. Oh, that one showed up a couple years later. You know what's best for others. Do I want what I have? Money equals value equals happiness. Laziness, respecting authority. People's behaviors are reflective on me. I demand respect. My path is the best. Money equals security. I want to be someone in AA. I deserve entitlement. I don't trust the process. I cannot control. I think I'm the greatest. Contemplate if we are all extensions of one another, God, then why am I the greatest? Good point. The status of greatness makes us less approachable. Others' recovery reflects on me. I want others to stay out of my life, but not me out of theirs. This is the stuff that reports back to me after I've done a thorough fourth and fifth step, to the point where I then take this stuff into prayer and meditation and work with it and try to see. And it's funny because I don't have all of the ones that have ever happened, but I know that there's a couple of these as I'm reading them. I know whose handwriting they are, and I know generally what set of work it's from. And some of that stuff's gone away. Some of it showed up again. This is my most recent six-step list. Envy, sloth, gluttony, expectation of what should be, lost touch with reality, delusion, self, dishonesty. Respect equals money, success equals money, need to set expectations, and I have entitlement. So this is the stuff that came up from the fifth step that I'm, or the fourth step that I'm currently reading to people that I started in February and finished in June. I mean, I've already read it to three people. I'll probably read it to a couple more. But these are all different considerations from different people. That this is the stuff I struggle with, guys. Does anybody else in here struggle with any of that stuff?
Yes.
Are we all that different? But yet we're so wrapped up in our own shit that we don't want to share our fourth step with somebody else. But you guys got it too.
Step six says nothing about me working on my defects. The reason I harm people through defects is because I fall asleep and I begin to live an unaware life. My eyes are wide open, but I'm completely asleep. I become fearful. I become driven. And when I become driven, there is no choice. And so I want to talk about this concept of driven. I put this little worksheet together. So, driven, compelled or impelled to steer, to forcibly take a course of action, guided by another force. Page 62 in the big book. Selfishness and self-centeredness, two of our biggest character defects. They think the authors of the book say this is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. Back to this little thing I wrote. When we are driven, we are consumed with self-centered, selfish behaviors. In an unaware state of consciousness, we're driven through life by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. Let's look at driven versus choice. Ask yourself this question. Do you have areas in your life today in which you're being driven versus making choices? Can you identify these areas by looking for fear? Or you can. If you do that, you will find these areas when you look for fear, a lack of consideration, and a great deal of reaction. So not response, but the pinball in the pinball machine. The greatest trick that the egoic mind plays on me is convincing me that clean and sober, I'm making choices. But when I look at these so-called choices, they're insane. I now understand I wasn't making choices. I was being driven. There was no choice because in self-will, there's no choice. There's only the manifestation of how I think my self-will should look or be manifested. The concept of choice comes from a state of neutrality with unselfish motives. It's an intellectual sorting out process in which I am presented with options. I consider them and either reject them, deny, or accept them. There's a reason the authors of the big book don't use the word denial around the first step. I don't think it was a matter of vocabulary, but instead a deliberate effort to drive home the concept of loss of choice. Instead, they use words like illusion, delusion, and obsession, all of which signal a low state of consciousness in which one cannot tell the difference between what's true and what's false. In this state of consciousness, we have no choice but to be driven without choice, harming others. These are what people call defects of character. One of my biggest defects of character is addiction and alcoholism, and it gets suppressed, but it can return. The symptoms of addiction and alcoholism can come back. So it demands ongoing and treatment. And so my defects of character also demand ongoing treatment. But the treatment is just awareness. Awareness. If you can be aware, you'll reach a point to where things move in your life much slower. And when they move slower, you have this grace period where you can actually follow the guideline in the book that says pause when agitated or doubtful. Pause when agitated or doubtful. If you can do that, you can turn out. And it's not that I'm making a choice to turn out. It's like I'm engaging with my wife, and she's exhibiting a behavior that I do not agree with, and I see the voices in my head, you must punish her now. You must make her feel wrong now. You must point out her deficiencies now. But with a high level of awareness, that's all they do, is they come and they go and I move out of it. I turn out. In an unaware state of consciousness, I rip her head off. You know, these are what people call defects of character. Selfishness, self-centeredness. A lot of my defects come in the form of incorrect belief systems. I don't have to work as hard as you, but I need to get more out of it. That's a good one.
So we've got somebody in here from Boston. Do we have anybody from like the West Coast or anything like that? So what's the next furthest away we've got other than Boston?
Texas.
Texas, that's a great, perfect example. So, You think if you're born and raised in Boston, and you're born and raised in Texas, you think that you're going to have some different programming? Maybe. I mean, I've lived in Texas. I know everything's bigger. I know they're better than everybody else. I've lived there, and I agree with a lot of that. I've been to Boston. I've dealt with people from Boston. Completely different state of mind. So is it possible, then, that the programming that we get from our environment helps drive our actions in our life? Is it possible that the people that we're up against have been given a set of thinking that they can't do any better? And yet I'm getting upset with the way that they're acting because it doesn't meet my programming. Who's right? Depends on who you talk to.
So, as long as I have an illusion of value attached to whatever I'm calling a defect of character, I will continue to act out in that defect. That's the long and the short of it. It's not until the last flicker of conviction that there is any value. That has to be snuffed out. As long as I'm getting something from it, I'll continue to do it. And to me, that's the difference between willing and being entirely ready. So part of when I take guys through the steps and they get this list of defects from me and a list of their belief systems that don't serve them anymore, is I have them either on a piece of paper or on a note card, write down your belief systems and your character defects that are not working for you. And what I want you to do is wait. Don't take your seventh step until God summons you. God's going to summon you. And what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is, in my experience, defects of character are usually removed while they're causing a ton of pain. And so, the first time I went through the steps, it was literally, I did my hour returning home. I had this broad and general list of defects, and I did my seven-step prayer. But when you wait until you're in the middle of an experience being crushed by the self-imposed crisis associated with your defects of character, it calls for a whole new surrender. Because you're going through something and you see how you can't change it, and you go to God authentically. It's not some little mechanical, I'm done with my fifth step, I did six, let's do seven. No, I'm going to wait until this defect is eating my lunch, and then I'm going to drop to my knees. I'm going to say the seven-step prayer. And if you're in a public place when you show your ass or you get, you know, beat down by this defect, then go to some place that's private and take your seventh step. It's just, I mean, it's not in the book, but I do think it's effective. That's my perspective on step 6 and 7, and I wanted to bring in the concept of being driven. Because literally that's what's going on when we're acting out in our defects. We are driven. And the only way to become undriven is to wake up. Wake up. You're not making choices. Programming. Conditioning.
Go on.
You want to do... And we'll just do 8.
Okay. So, step 8. Page 76. Now we need more action. Without which we find that faith without works is dead. So, how do I really remove my defect? I can't do it. It has to come from outside of me. But what is the mechanism in which those defects get removed from me? Because if I've done a thorough fourth and fifth step, I see that crap that I saw that showed up in 6, and I really, really don't want it. So when I do the seventh step prayer, I really, really mean it. They don't just disappear. There has to be a mechanism through which they go away. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of the persons we had harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. So if I've got a competent sponsor, that sponsor's taking notes and keeping track of some of the people that I harmed while they were listening to my fifth step. And they're kind of jotting this stuff down. And so they give me that sheet at the end of inventory, and they say, here are the people that I see that you harmed that you need to go make amends to. We subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage of the past. Interesting, it says, now we go out to our fellows and we say, it doesn't say, now we go out to our fellows and we say we're sorry. Does it? You know why? Because the people we're saying we're sorry to already know we're sorry. Because we've said it before. We attempt to sweep away the debris which is accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning we would go to any lengths, it's any lengths here, for victory over alcohol. So, our real purpose on page 77, it tells us, is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. So, the eighth and ninth step are about being of maximum service. It is my personal experience that if I go out and I knock on enough doors trying to make amends and making amends for being an asshole, at some point in time, I'm going to realize that I'm an asshole. At that moment, when I realize that, oh wait, this isn't just showing up in one situation, it's showing up in a bunch of them, that defect that I identified in the sixth step starts to be pulled from me. It is the mechanism through the eighth and the ninth step that some of that leaves me, because I don't have the ability to just wish it away. Remember, thought, word, action, the spiritual requirements for anything to happen. I have to do something for those defects to be removed. Where do we want to go on all this?
No cards.
Okay, you want to hit that?
Yeah. So when I first got, when I got to my eighth step the very first time, my sponsor at the time had me create four lists. I made a list of people I was willing to make amends to right now. I made a list of people I was going to make amends to later. I made a list of people that I might do one day. And I made a list of people that I would never do. That was in early 2008. That was probably around March of 2008. And about 3 months ago, maybe 10 weeks ago, maybe 3 months ago, I approached the last set of people, the last five people that I'm consciously aware that I've harmed. I had 230 people and institutions on my first eight-step list. I owed over $30,000 in amends. I still have financial amends to make. I've paid over $10,000 back in almost, so 8 years, and I've been making amends for 8 years and 4 months. So the book says a long period of reconstructions ahead. It's taken me that long. Now, granted, of those 230, I wrote probably close to 35 letters because I didn't know the last name. The people were either, they had passed away. But what I did was I went and this is getting more into amends. I only want to talk about the lists. Okay. So, that's what I did. So, all I worked on was my right now list. And then I worked on my later list. Then the maybes. Then the never started moving over. When I was about a year and a half, though, I moved away and I started using this note card system. So I went back through my list and put everything on note cards. So we get these 3x5 cards. You put the name of the person you owe the amends to. You put the contact information, if you have it, phone, email address, physical address. Then you write out a few words that help you understand how you harm them. How much money do you owe them? Be specific and be concise. These are the three questions to always ask when making amends. Did I leave anything out or that I'm not aware of? And so what I usually write on the note card is anything else? Question mark. Do you need to tell me how any of this made you feel? I write how you feel? Question mark. And then what can I do to make things right between us? And I write make right? Question mark. Now, there are some amends that I went and made where I actually took the card with me, and then I was instructed not to do that anymore, so I just reviewed it and said a prayer, and I left it in my card. And then in the top right-hand corner, you put a plus minus or a plus plus. Now, here's what these mean. Plus plus means you're willing to make the amends and you know how to find them. That's the right now list. Plus minus means you're willing to make the amends, but you don't know how to find them. So that might be your later list. You're not willing to make the amends, but you know how to find them. That could be on your never list or your later list. You're not willing to make the amends and you have no idea how to find them. That's definitely a never list item. But it's the same concept of the original list that I use, except we're breaking it down into a process and a system that makes sense. Somebody earlier this weekend was talking to me about being concerned about all these amends you have to make. So when I take guys through and they come to me, they've got all their note cards, and I say, okay, I want to make four piles. Plus, 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 minus, minus, plus, and minus, minus. And I don't care if you I want you to make all your amends, but if you have a 10 or 15 in your never list, I'm cool with that. Because I understand how the spiritual process works. I get it. As you make all the plus plus amends, the ones that were minus plus become plus plus. That's what happens when you start to have personal experience. You start to realize, holy shit, I had no idea what these were going to look like, and they've turned out great. And then the ones I thought were going to be easy and simple turned out to be a pain in the ass. I really don't know what's going on. This is sort of exciting. Let's go make some more amends. And then you get caught up in that energy. And as you start to straighten out the past, all these doors start opening and your life just starts changing. I can't even explain it to you properly because you have to do it yourself. And I am convinced with every cell in my body that the reason I've had the opportunities that I've had in my recovery are twofold. My constant work with others. Since I was 4 months clean and sober, I've been taking men through this big book, and I've never let up. And I have sought out to make every amends that I'm consciously aware of. And that is balancing the books between myself and the universe for the most part. I continually put back into the universe. I give people back their money. My mind wants to tell me I'm giving them my money. No, I'm giving them back their money. This is important stuff. And so that's the process in the system for the list. So I guarantee you your largest stack will most likely be plus plus. And you could work on plus plus for the better part of a year. Who knows? You could have 75, 80 amends that are all plus plus. What I need to impress upon you is you need to be in the action of making amends. So the minus minus, that's the last thing we're going to deal with. That could be 2-3 years into your recovery. I don't know what the time frame is. In this day and age, with the way of Skype and FaceTime and all, I mean, looking eye to eye to somebody is possible. I've tracked down a lot of people using Facebook. I didn't make an amends on Facebook, but I tracked people down and I sent them a little message. I said, hey, I'm going back through my life and I'm repairing the damage that I've caused. I feel like I caused you some harm. I am willing to sit down with you and discuss this and to make things right. If you're ever willing to sit down with me, please contact me. Here's my phone number. Here's my email address. I don't give them my physical address. They can contact me. And then on the back of the note card, I write, June 24, 2016, sent message on Facebook. And then I wait. Maybe 2 months. Maybe 2 months if I have a phone number or I call and leave a voicemail. If I've now sent a message on Facebook and saw they read it, left a voicemail on the phone. I ain't going to try to contact this person again. They don't want to see me. I've become willing to make that amends. It is complete. If God wants that one set right, God will bring them back into my life. I have now become willing. I do my best to make all amends direct, face to face. That's the intent. And I could spend the entire rest of this evening talking to you about the process of making amends. Because it's where you learn how to trust God. Your sponsors are going to hold your hand through the first 8 steps, and then they go, it's you and God. I can't take you to the amends. I can drive you, but I can't walk in with you. This is how you learn how to have faith and trust in God. This is the result of being willing, taking some action, getting some results, developing faith, and going for trust. This is the process. This is how it evolves. And you make more decisions. You make more amends. You get more faith. You get more trust. And you watch amazing things happen. You truly do. That's where I'm going to go deeper into amends, but that's the 8th step right there. Let's take a break and come back at 5 after.